From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our regular conversation with Professor Luciana Bone focuses on the change from a socialist economy to a market economy in Russia and the changes to the economy in China that have taken place over the last 30 or 40 years. Okay, Luciana, it's a pleasure to have you back. And this is a very interesting topic. We're looking at the best place to start is with the definition of terms getting clarified. And why not start with China as far as that goes?
Sure. We are going to talk and present a contrast between the transition to a market economy, a contrast between China and the Soviet Union in their respective transitions to a market economy. And the important thing is to distinguish, to look into how Jiao Ping Deng in 1979 in an interview defined the market. So he, in November 1979, a year after the decision of the party to transition to a socialist market economy, a socialist market economy, there is such a thing, he said, "It is wrong to maintain that a market economy exists only in capitalist society, and that there is only capitalist market economy. Why can't we develop a market economy under socialism? Developing a market economy does not mean practicing capitalism. While maintaining a planned economy as the mainstay of our economic system, we're also introducing a market economy. But it is a socialist market economy. Although a socialist market economy is similar to a capitalist one in method, there are also differences between them. The socialist market economy mainly regulates interrelations between state-owned enterprises, between collectively owned enterprises, and even between foreign capitalist enterprises. But in the final analysis, this is all done under socialism in a socialist society. This is something Western leftists find very hard to understand or to appreciate. And they end up calling China capitalist,
right?
Because it's acting in the market. So this is what the Chinese reforms starting in 1978 had in mind. And what I want to... So in effect, they enacted, China enacted reforms that would preserve the socialist character of the state and of the society. And to conduct these reforms, the Chinese Communist Party did not invite the guidance of Western hands. And also, instead of following the Big Bang model of transitioning to a market economy as quickly as possible, as the former Eastern European communist countries and Russia did, China took a gradual approach. And Deng likened this approach to, quote, crossing the river by feeling for stones. So the contrast that I want to set up is, as briefly as possible, to go over the 90s, what the Soviet Union did, Russia eventually, did to transition to a market economy, and what China did. But briefly going over the Soviet story. Amusingly, I just got a message from a friend in Germany about a conference in Bremen, academic conference at the University of Bremen, where a participant was asked, does China actually do everything right? And the professor answered, simple question, simple answer. And the answer is yes. China goes ways that humanity has never gone. And that, with the speed and ease of change, I don't agree with the speed because it took 30 years, and that with the speed and ease of change that is only possible if the working people are actually at the heart of political, of politics, and especially if the system offers them social security for the future. So I want to argue that China's reforms, which took place in three phases, 1978, 2013, and 2017, strengthened the Chinese Communist Party as a political power and as economic planner. Whereas the Soviet Union's reforms, as we have talked in former conversation, dissolved the Communist Party as a political power and economic planner. That the Soviet Union transition from a socialized economy to a capitalist market economy in a jiffy without setting up institutions, whereas China moved from what was an inefficient socialized economy for many reasons. China in 1978 had 17 state-owned enterprises. It now has zillions. Anyway, China moved from an inefficient socialized economy to a socialist market economy. You were going to say, Don.
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the Soviet Union, for example, I mean, it's difficult to say when the period of reform, quote-unquote, began, because we've been discussing, for example, that even the road to capitalism began with at least Khrushchev back in the 1950s with the denunciation of Stalin and, by implication, everything that had been done in terms of socialist construction up to that point. But it's certainly coming into the period that, you know, that began, you know, in fact, in 1991, you had in advance of that an abandonment of the leading role of the Communist Party in the society and in the government. So first of all, in essence, a bourgeoisification of the state, what had been a worker state, at least nominally. I mean, you can argue the essence of that till you're blue in the face with people of every persuasion. But there was no question that after the legislation was enacted, the Communist Party no longer controlled the state. And also, by extension, the economy, since the two were more or less unified at the top. So they walk into the whole, you know, marketization of the economy, we'll say, certainly the privatization of it in the Soviet Union and Russia, with the Communist Party out of the box before they go in. That the Communist Party
still
remains.
Actually, what you had was an absence of power and a competition among oligarchs. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. But I'm just saying, compared and contrasted with China, even now, while China has grown this, you know, economic megilla with market forces, with Western capital and its own capital and everything else that has people questioning its essence, Communist Party is still in the driver's seat and still very much integrated into the working class.
That's right. And it did these reforms in two steps. The first one was economic development to feed and attend to the needs of the people. And the second phase, starting with Xi Jinping in 2013, was the restructuring of institutions, financial and economic and political, etc. So what we have in China is, first, take care of the needs of the people. Second, now that we have this 30-year experience practically with dealing with, you know, capitalist economies, etc., now we need to restructure the and clean up and organize the structures that are supporting this change. Do you see what I mean?
Yes,
but anyway,
I do.
We'll get there.
Yeah, and in addition, just one other point I wanted to make on that too. Even in Russia, as an example of post-Soviet space, as the example, even though the Communist Party is not formally or even in fact in control of the economy at the pinnacle or of the state, it's well represented in both areas, and the relationship of the private institutions and the state, even outside of that condition, I would say certainly bears the legacy of relationship that existed while the Communist Party was the leading institution in the society. In other words, the people expect certain things from the Russian state that they've had for 80 years before. The state interacts with them. I mean, look at the popularity of Putin as opposed to the popularity of any Western leader at all. You know, that's based not on propaganda, unless it's some really good propaganda, but rather on the material relationship between the Kremlin and the population of Russia. And that is something that was flaked and formed not under the Tsar, but under the Soviet government and the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
Exactly. You can consider the 90s as an attempt to erase the Soviet past.
Right.
And you can interpret the accession of Putin to the, want to call it power, to the presidency, the prime minister, you know, as a rollback of that intervention in the 90s. Because, for one thing, as you noted in former conversations, Putin set out to do the number one necessary thing, and that is renationalize the energy sector.
Right.
And so, yes, you're right. And of course, the reformed Communist Party, sort of nationalist type, commands 40% of votes, at least it did in 19... I mean, it could have won in 1996.
It actually should have won. There was severe meddling, which, you know, has finally come out. There were documents that were released under FOIL and such.
And under Clinton.
Yeah, Bill Clinton.
The Clinton Foundation released pretty damning evidence of Yeltsin asking for $3 billion.
And pretty much getting it. Yep, and pretty much getting it, saying, look, I need at least $1 billion to pay off pensions and to do this or that, or else I'm not going to make it. And as it turned out, he got the money. And the pensioners got the money, and he won the election, according to the people that counted the votes. And that's another question also.
Yes. Yes. I mean, the 90s was, So to elaborate on this contrast, let us go back to the, you call it bourgeoisification, call it the counter-revolution.
The same difference.
In Russia, in Soviet Union, and then Russia in the... and elsewhere in the 90s. So by contrast to the Chinese Communist Party reforming themselves and then use the most wonderful, I want to say, the brightest economists, they were Chinese Marxist economists. They were homegrown. So China did not... the Soviet Union accepted Western guidance, to put it mildly, and tutoring under Gorbachev and Yeltsin. And in the late 1980s, and massively after the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the dissolution of the Communist Party, an army of American government policymakers, economic and financial advisors, journalists, scholars, including evangelists, invaded Moscow. The idea was to create an elite core of experts to live in the former Soviet Union, help officials there run government and business. So in Russia, reforms in the 1990s decapitated the Communist Party, introduced capitalist economic reforms in their most lethal form, in the form of shock therapy, which devastated the population, so that the proper adjective for the policies that introduced naked capitalism to Russia is not reformist, but reactionary. And the noun for the process that enacted it is counter-revolution. So yes, what happened in the 90s was an attempt to absolutely reverse and erase the Soviet Union, a cost at whatever cost. So this did not happen in China. This is an important point. So then Clinton and Yeltsin, as we know, were buddies. Clinton wanted a vassal Russia. And this is what, of course, generates the hatred now, because this vassal slipped out of their hands. He wanted something like Poland. So Yeltsin needed, as you pointed out, American money to avoid a total economic collapse and therefore his electoral defeat, which Clinton didn't want.
Right. Not to avoid, by the way, but to postpone until after the election. Because it wasn't that he was trying to avoid a total economic collapse, because a loan doesn't help you do that. What he wanted to do was postpone it until after the election.
Correct. Yes. Thank you for that. Yeah. So when Clinton raised plans, so for example, there was such a buddy, and this is another thing that we have to remember. When Clinton raised plans to expand the NATO alliance into Eastern Europe, Yeltsin didn't object. Right. Now, you know, the object was also to expand into Russia proper.
Right.
And they agreed that, in fact, they did agree that Russia itself might one day join NATO. So what's behind Russophobia? The vassal slipped out of the hands and NATO is out of Russia.
Right.
Those two things are a slap in the face of all these billions and billions and planners that went in for 70 years before 1990 to destroy the Soviet Union. If you had Giulietto Chiesa on your program, the Italian journalist who was a member of the Italian official Communist Party and knows Russia inside and out. I think, remember, you had Giulietto Chiesa.
Long time ago, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, he, and I posted this and circulated on my FB page, long interview about what happened in the 90s because he was there. Yeah. And he said that the Yeltsin and their team and his team were not independent of their actions, in their action.
Right.
They made decisions based on advice and orders from the United States. The main decisions were written in Harvard and faxed to Moscow.
Right.
And they were written by Jeffrey Sachs, who, of course, had done a job on Poland. And they believed that the transition from socialism to capitalism would have been simple if their recommendation were applied swiftly. And all the Russian liberal economists were imbued with the economic culture and influence of the United States, so they were for privatization, the devaluation of the ruble, and all the other piratical measures. Now, I just want to read this anecdote that Giulietto Chiesa, the Italian journalist, mentioned. He says things like these are never mentioned in our sources in mainstream. So he writes that in 1992, the Gaidar government, that's Yegor Gaidar, a young economist who was sacked by Yeltsin because the shock therapy policies that he applied threatened a revolution in Russia, a new revolution. So he writes that this Yegor Gaidar, who was the finance minister and something else in Yeltsin's government, had held a large meeting in Nizhny Novgorod in 1992 with several members of the reform team, that's the capitalist liberal team. Neo-capitalist. It was the meeting between them and the so-called red directors, that is the economic and industrial leaders of the Soviet era, between 500 and 600 of them. Of course, they were called here hardline communists. So these directors tried to explain to these reformers, these young reformers who sat in the presidium, how the economy of the country actually worked.
Right.
They tried to convince them that they didn't oppose the changes in the system, but that it should not lead to the general closure of companies. They warned that there would otherwise be millions of workers expelled from production who would suddenly lose all means of livelihood, and that this would have devastating effects on the whole of society.
Right.
They were rather naive. They were speaking to the wall. They insisted that reform should not be identified only with privatization and that industrial production should be protected, at least within certain limits. And what was the response? Well, all those young leaders listened with hostility and contempt, Giulietto Chiesa says, invariably replied that the transition to capitalism had to be fast and carried out decisively, that there would be no difficulty, that foreign capital would arrive, substantial investment, that it was necessary to close the unprofitable factories, and I think, says Giulietto Chiesa, I think that the disappointment towards reforms and reformers began to produce resistance among the population against the transformation, and this is 92, against this transformation. It was at this stage that the reformers themselves realized that millions of people react with protest to their decision.
Yep.
And they began ways to study to neutralize the possible uprising, which
right.
of course occurred in the fall of 1993. And Chiesa says it was the most immense popular protest he had seen. It was a gigantic demonstration. This is 1993.
Mm-hmm.
That literally broke the encirclement of the White House that had been set up by Yeltsin. And the popular fury was really great. The Moscovites at that moment expressed the general feeling of Russians, he says. They fooled us.
Mm.
In fact, the country found itself on the edge of the new revolution. So
right.
the revolt of the Supreme Soviet of the Russian Federation against Yeltsin was none other than the match that lit the fuse. And, of course,
right.
this was put down.
Right.
So, if I may conclude with Russia, I don't know how much time we have left.
Just something I want to. While you're talking about Giulietto Chiesa, I'm reminded that he was one of the first people to identify the creature Mikhail Saakashvili as a puppet of the West of Europe, in particular. I think saying that Saakashvili was responsible for the war, and you're referring to this class.
Yes,
and you're referring to this class of experts that were shipped over to the Soviet Union. You know, I'm going to channel Marx, you know, history repeating itself twice, first as tragedy, then as farce. Now the farce is Saakashvili is one of the experts that's exported by this group of clowns to help Ukraine fumble its way through freezing to death over the winter.
Can you imagine?
Yep.
Yeah. I just can't believe what has happened,
yeah.
you know, since the fall of the Berlin Wall. So let's do a tally of what happened.
Yeah.
A minor tally of the tragedy that these reformers, these Harvard linked, these reformers did to Lenin's Russia, to Stalin's Russia, you're right. It began with Khrushchev.
Yeah.
Anyway, by 1993, between 39% and 49% of the population was living in poverty. Life expectancy dropped for men from 64 to 57.
Yeah, that was inside of 3 years.
Yep.
That means a lot of people died, a lot.
Yeah. Women dropped from 74 to 71. 3 years, okay. Alcohol-related deaths skyrocketed.
Yep.
60%, I'm rushing here. Alcohol-related deaths skyrocketed 60% in the 1990s.
Mm.
And this is also significant. Deaths from infectious and parasitic diseases.
Right, that's right.
Shut up, yep. 100%.
Yep.
This is the first thing that Stalin's 30s tackled, infectious diseases. So, and they were eliminated. Now, by 1996, 10% of the population owned 90% of the national income.
Yep.
And, of course, we know other consequences, racketeer, black market, murders, robbery, prostitution.
Right, gangsterism.
Etc. Now, the only one shocking statistics that I didn't mention, I think I mentioned it before, is that the estimate by the medical journal, the famous medical journal in England, the estimate of deaths related to this Big Bang transition to capitalism is estimated to have been 10 million throughout the Soviet Union and 7 million in Russia.
Yeah. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that's what they claimed Stalin killed millions of people in the transition from feudalism to a modern economy, and yet this was done right under our nose with our tax dollars, no less. And it's a fact that this happened.
Yeah, that's right. It's not a fact of propaganda. It's a fact.
Right. That's right. It's not a controversy at all. Well, you're talking about like the medical journals are reporting it in the West.
The Lancet. Yeah. Well, the Lancet is the granddaddy of medical journals. In Britain. Yes. And go on. Sorry, I interrupted you. I remember the name,
okay.
The Lancet Medical Journal.
That's all. That's all I'm wondering.
It's the one that quoted the 10 million related deaths to shock therapy.
That's a lot. And 7 million inside of Russia, and Russia has a population of about 150 million. So you're talking about somewhere around 5% of the population died.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
That's a remarkable number.
That's it. So I would like, the point of actually you are talking about this contrast is, please think twice before you call China capitalist.
Please, yeah.
Okay, because that contrast is enormous, and I'm going to go into this, and if we can't finish today, we'll finish.
Yeah, we have 2 minutes from right now, so.
Okay, so first of all, the Communist Party of China did make real reforms, but they were gradual, as I said, and they proceeded from 1978 to 2017. So the first step under Deng was economic development, as I mentioned, to improve livelihood. And the second step was the three reforms, administrative, legislative, and financial, of under Xi in 2017. Yeah, that was the big Congress. He reformed the institutions to accommodate for the economic development. In the opinion of many, the reforms in China secured and preserved the path to socialism, while the reforms in the Soviet Union destroyed the path to socialism. Not totally.
Right.
Thank goodness.
Right.
Okay, so these reforms and open door policy of China began with the adoption of a new economic development strategy at the third plenary session of the 11th Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party in late 1978, under, of course, the leadership of Deng Xiaoping. What he said in 1978 was, failing to adhere to socialism, to carry out reform and opening up, to develop the economy and to improve people's livelihoods can only lead up to a blind alley. The basic line governs 100 years and must not be shaken. The basic line. Again, a contrast to what happened in the Soviet Union. The basic line would be that of the Chinese Communist Party.
We're going to have to come back to this next week. And thank you very much, Luciana. We'll speak with you again then.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.